This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, 50 years of the lice. Over the course of his long career, W.S. Merwin has published many books of poetry. He's turning 90 later this year, and he's still going strong. 50 years ago, Merwin published a book of poems with the rather unsavory title, The Lice. There's no poem in the book that bears that title, though. The only explanation for it comes in the epigraph of the book from Heraclitus.
All men are deceived by the appearances of things. Even Homer himself, who was the wisest man in Greece, for he was deceived by boys catching lice. They said to him, "What we have caught and what we have killed, we have left behind. But what has escaped us, we bring with us."
That passage from Heraclitus was read by Craig Morgan Teicher, who joins me to talk about Merwin's book and why it is so powerfully relevant today. Craig is a poet and essayist and a frequent guest on this podcast. Craig, going back to the epigraph, the boys say about lice, "What we have caught and what we have killed, we have left behind, but what has escaped us, we bring with us." In other words, they have lice.
Right.
And are we supposed to think that the poems in this book are the lice that Merwin, him, the poet, couldn't catch or kill and that he carries around with him? What do you make of that?
I don't know. It's a book about having gone past giving up a little bit,
uh-huh.
You know? It's a book about having gone past defending yourself. I feel like the lice are this kind of end of days pestilence that he kind of feels has infested discourse. I mean, the language, the poems, and obviously America and the world at that time.
Yeah. It's a daring title for a book of poems. It's not something that's going to go leaping up the shelf at you when you see a title called The Lice. Let's hear one of the poems from the book before we really get talking about it. This is one of the most famous poems in a book that has a good number of famous poems. It's called "For the Anniversary of My Death." Do you want to say anything about this one before we actually hear it?
It's a poem. It's one of those greatest hits poems that people are always pulling out and being like, "Read this great poem."
Yeah.
I've
done that to people.
Yeah. You know, it's like, "Oh man, think about it, man. You could have died today later."
Yeah.
and for me, there are poems in this book that I love a lot more.
Okay.
This poem always strikes me as sort of anomalous in this book and kind of accessible for it.
All right. But it's still still a great poem. Let's hear it. Here's Merwin reading it.
"For the anniversary of my death. Every year, without knowing it, I have passed the day when the last fires will wave to me, and the silence will set out, tireless traveler, like the beam of a lightless star. Then I will no longer find myself in life as in a strange garment, surprised at the earth, and the love of one woman, and the shamelessness of men. As today, writing after 3 days of rain, hearing the wren sing and the falling cease, and bowing, not knowing to what."
That was "For the Anniversary of My Death" from a Cadman recording. Craig, the conceit is one that other poets have exploited, that every year we have a death day, and we don't know it because we haven't died yet, of course. And it forces the poet to think about his life in terms of his death. And what stands out to me here is the kind of stark elemental qualities of the language itself. "When the last fires will wave to me and the silence will set out, tireless traveler, like the beam of a lightless star." It's beautiful language, elemental, almost biblically beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, one of the major things that happens in this book for Merwin and the book that precedes it, and one of the reasons I think we remember this book so much, is that he's been sort of whittling away at the complexity of his language.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is his sixth book.
He's mid-career at this point.
Yeah.
Practically.
He's really resetting and restarting himself as a poet in the 60s. But he really began as a kind of late Pre-Raphaelite. I mean, the early books are ornate. They're deeply referential. You want to read them with a compendium alongside.
Mm.
And he spent a few years really trying to figure out how he could strip those habits away from his writing. So throughout The Lice and in this poem, you see images like the last fires. There's lots of crows. There's lots of branches, just symbols that pretty clearly stand for themselves or dark feelings, ominousness.
And they're elemental, stars, silence, fires, and then incredibly interesting and beautiful last line, and bowing not knowing to what. That's reverence for the created world.
And for whatever's after it, you know. Right. I mean, it's a marvelous exit from a poem. It leaves the poem so open and yet points it at death in this way that is celebratory,
mm-hmm.
which is pretty rare, I think.
Then I will no longer find myself in life as in a strange garment, surprised at the earth and the love of one woman and the shamelessness of men. As today, writing after 3 days of rain, hearing the wren sing and the falling cease, and bowing, not knowing to what.
There's no punctuation. This is a very typical Merwin poem that becomes typical later in his career. No punctuation. You have to kind of figure it out, the pauses, as you read through it. Elemental, as it were.
Yeah, and, you know, the dropping out of punctuation is the other, I mean, it's probably the most obvious stylistic innovation and change that he made in the book that precedes this one and this one. I mean, he just decided no more punctuation. I'm going to make the sentences have to punctuate themselves with rhythm and with line breaks and with just how they operate.
Mm-hmm. Now, that poem could have been written almost anywhere in his career from this point on. But many of the poems in the book seem to come out of a specific moment in history. It was published in 1967. The Vietnam War was raging. Merwin was actively engaged against the Vietnam War. There was tremendous social upheaval in the country, not unlike today in some ways. But frame this book for us in terms of the larger world that he's responding to.
Well, I was reading an interview last night just to get ready, and, you know, he was at a place where he basically just felt, this is it. This is the end. It can't get any worse. I mean, he was just basically thinking, there's no point to writing poems. There's not much of a point to doing anything. The world's about to, you know, we're about to break it permanently.
Mm.
And he talks about these poems as having come upon him or sort of seized him when he wasn't looking, and that they just sort of uttered themselves. I do think that it was a time that, like this time, the political and the sort of global sphere seems to just be untethered, you know, and this was the last time that it felt like that to this extent. I think this book is going to feel very familiar now.
Yeah. And speaking of feeling familiar, I'd like to get you to read a poem called For a Coming Extinction. And this poem seems so far ahead of its time in terms of its environmental awareness. It blew me away reading it again. This is For a Coming Extinction.
Gray whale, now that we are sending you to the end, that great God, tell him that we who follow you invented forgiveness and forgive nothing. I write as though you could understand, and I could say it. One must always pretend something among the dying. When you have left the seas nodding on their stalks, empty of you, tell him that we were made on another day. The bewilderment will diminish like an echo, winding along your inner mountains, unheard by us, and find its way out, leaving behind it the future, dead, and ours. When you will not see again the whale calves trying the light, consider what you will find in the black garden and its court, the sea cows, the great auks, the gorillas, the irreplaceable hosts ranged countless and foreordaining as stars, our sacrifices. Join your word to theirs. Tell him that it is we who are important.
Yeah, that was For a Coming Extinction. And he really twists the knife at the end. Tell him that it is we who are important. The we being us humans, we who are causing the coming extinction of the gray whale, as well as the great auks and the gorillas and the sea cows and all these other creatures that the gray whale is supposed to meet in the great beyond. The poem reads like an indictment of humanity.
And it's so strange. It sort of asks this favor. I mean, it treats the whale like this ambassador, you know?
Yeah.
And this sort of nice, innocent ambassador. And there's this funny, I don't know, it's this intertwined guilt and pride that, you know, it is we who are important. I mean, at some level, I mean, guilt for, you know, destroying the earth, pride for having been able to destroy the earth and being able to admit it and articulate it. I don't know.
Yeah.
He's making fun of that pride in a way, but it's very dark.
Very dark. And on one level, can't you read it as an attack on the biblical idea that the world and all the creatures in it were made for man?
Yeah.
And it seems to be taking a very different point of view there. It's satirizing that point of view.
Yeah, definitely. Well, and certainly if they were made for man, they weren't made for man to just utterly destroy. And quickly.
There's one passage in here that strikes me as very compelling and odd. I write as though you could understand and I could say it. One must always pretend something among the dying. That sort of pretend something in the face of death. What do you make of that? It's like it's as if civilization is pretending something in the face of a coming calamity.
Well, I can't help but think about it'll all be okay. You know, I mean that you tell, you're sitting at somebody's bedside and you say like, we'll be fine after you die, though we'll miss you, or you say, you're going to heaven and it's going to be great, or you say, I don't know, you know, like at the end of Saving Private Ryan, like you lived a good life, you know?
Right.
That seems like a much more devastating thing to say in light of like, the world's coming to an end because we broke it, but it'll be okay, you know?
Right. One must always pretend something among the dying. That's one of the most memorable lines. Yeah. I'd like to get you to read another poem, and it was one that puzzled me, and I think I finally have a handle on it. It's called I Live Up Here. It's about politics and about one's engagement with politics. And that, I won't say anything more than that, but it took me a while to arrive at that, a couple of readings, and so it might be helpful to listeners as they listen to the poem.
I live up here and a little bit to the left, and I go down only for the accidents and then never a moment too soon. Just the same, it's a life, it's plenty. The stairs, the pedals, she loves me every time. Nothing has changed. Oh, down there, every time, the glass knights lie by their gloves of blood. In the pans of the scales, the helmets brim over with water. It's perfectly fair. The pavements are dealt out the dice. Every moment arrives somewhere. You can hear the hearses getting lost in lungs, their bells stalling. And then silence comes with a plate, and I give what I can, feeling it's worth it. For I see what my votes, the mice, are accomplishing, and I know I'm free. This is how I live up here, and simply. Others do otherwise, maybe.
Now, when I first read that poem, I was quite confused by what he was getting at. And then I, of course, reread it. And then about the third reading, I think I got it, and I felt really guilty. I felt that it was a personal indictment of my own sort of political positioning from remove. So he begins the poem, I live up here a little bit to the left. It's exactly
right,
where I
live. Right.
Politically, he means the political left. There's no other way to read that. And I go down only for the accidents, and then never a moment too soon. So when there's a political emergency, as we've experienced in this country recently, we get involved. Just the same, it's a life, it's plenty. The stairs, the pedals, she loves me. In other words, I still have my personal life. I still have all these good things in my life. Nothing has changed.
The pedals is such a wonderfully haunting image. I mean, you know,
yeah.
Somehow he never pulls every other pedal that says she loves me not.
Yeah, he's got it going on up there.
Yeah.
Nothing has changed. Oh, down there, every time the glass knights lie by their gloves of blood. So there's an image of violence and destruction. Glass does not reconstitute itself. It is a jab at someone who is interested in politics, but not totally engaged in the importance of what the political project is.
Well, and even a jab at designating it the political project, as opposed to life. You know?
Exactly.
I mean, I feel like 5 months ago, 6 months ago, we were all kind of saying this poem to each other. And certainly the left has been whipped into a frenzy of activity. Whether it would kind of overcome the high bar this poem sets, I don't know. I mean, I think everyone would feel a little judged by this poem.
Don't you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Totally. I love what my votes, the mice, are accomplishing.
Yeah. That's a wonderful image. What my votes, the mice, are accomplishing, and I know I'm free.
Yeah.
In the last poem, he stuck the knife in humanity, and now he sticks it into liberals.
Yeah, yeah.
He really does. There's one poem in the Lice that you told me before we did this podcast that is one of your favorite poems of all time.
Yep.
It's a long poem. It's called The Last One. And it's too long for the podcast, but I wanted to give you a chance to give you a shot to convince people to go to Poetry Foundation's website, click on this poem, or buy the Lice or Merwin's poems and read this poem because it's pretty great. So what do you love about The Last One?
Well, so it's this poem about basically this population of Adams and Eves kind of, or it sort of starts with an Adam and Eve like couple, and they chop down the last tree after having chopped down all the other trees, and out from under that tree kind of this shadow grows that over the course of the poem, as they try to get rid of the shadow, as they try to bury it and ignore it and get away from it, it keeps growing and growing and growing and eventually gets on everything until it has sort of consumed everything. And it's just the most basic and encompassing metaphor I've ever encountered. The shadow represents this kind of comeuppance or this kind of revenge of the world that we have broken.
Can you read the very beginning of the poem?
Yeah.
Because the language is also elemental and biblical sounding and fable-like.
Yeah, and it's also one of the only poems in the book where he does punctuate. Every line ends with a period, which feels, again, elemental. It's like he's, you know, each statement is sort of the end. Mm-hmm. It opens with the most wonderful uses of the word well that I've ever come across. Well, they'd made up their minds to be everywhere because why not? Everywhere was theirs because they thought so. They with two leaves, they whom the birds despise. In the middle of stones, they made up their minds. They started to cut. Well, they cut everything because why not? Everything was theirs because they thought so. It fell into its shadows and they took both away. Some to have, some for burning.
Keep read a little bit more. Yeah.
Well, cutting everything, they came to the water. They came to the end of the day. There was one left standing. They would cut it tomorrow, they went away. The night gathered in the last branches. The shadow of the night gathered in the shadow on the water. The night and the shadow put on the same head. And it said, now.
And the poem develops in about 7 to 8 more stanzas, and this shadow takes on a more and more prominent role in the poem. And it's a devastating poem. And again, it feels like an indictment of all of us.
And part of what's so sinister about the poem is it's so pleasurable to read. I mean, it's funny. It's just mechanically, he makes the shadow just, it feels really organic and right. That's what a shadow would do. It would get on you.
Mm-hmm.
You're enjoying it so much, and then you just feel horrible.
It's not a despair. I read the Lice and I think I don't feel despairing when I read it, although I recognize that's where it comes from. So why should we go back, make the case for why we should go back and read this book 50 years later? What is it going to do for us?
Well, at some level, what makes it not despairing is it's also a little funny.
Yeah.
It's gallows humor. It's jokes the dead would tell or something. But I think it comes out of the necessity to figure out how to find one's life force at a time when one really has given up hope, maybe for good reason, you know, or when one really kind of looks to one's leaders and sees them not leading, you know, or sees them leading everyone astray. And I think that for a lot of people, that's how this moment feels. Mm. And I think this book has a lot to say about how to manage those feelings.
Mm.
I mean, it's certainly not meant to take those feelings away. It's meant to amplify them. It's meant to focus them.
Mm-hmm.
It's a book that is moralizing without exactly being prescriptive. It doesn't I mean, it basically says, be better, be a better person, but it doesn't really have much faith that you will. And then maybe on the other side of it, you know, you don't want to give up there. And so you keep going.
And Merwin himself definitely kept going and still going strong today. Very, very active environmentalist. And he lives out in Hawaii on an island and has been a force for environmental consciousness for a very, very long time. Thanks, Craig.
Yeah.
Craig Morgan Teicher is a poet, essayist, and editor. You can read some of his prose on our website, where you can also find a healthy number of poems by W.S. Merwin, including the last one, that whole poem. Do let us know what you think of this podcast. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.